Okay.
Do you want to comment more at this point, or should we simply open it?
Let's open it, but I'd like to come back to the puzzlement that you raised in the second, but at some point, if we get a chance to do that, because I have a suggestion, at least in regard to the example that you raised, but I don't want to hog everything here, so I think we should open up to other commentators. So the floor is open, whatever, questions, objections?
This is tied into the puzzlement that was written, raised about this expansion of empirical consciousness. What is it, you mentioned, by way of contrast, a more or less standard notion of empirical consciousness that's held by some students of Lonergan, and then this expansion would be a contrast to it. How would you characterize the difference between the two, and that might be a way into...
The difference, if you look at that schema on page 12 in the paper, the ordinary notion of empirical consciousness that I think most of us hold, and that I was presuming, but it was always a little bit dissatisfied with, is data and perceptual images, but not the free images, well, maybe the free images, but we don't have an idea of free images and utterances commonly under the influence of the higher levels, but at the empirical level. At the empirical level, under the influences of the higher levels, before they provide a basis for inquiry and reflection. And that's what I'm trying to get at. You know, I'm trying to fill that part of it out a little bit. And I think that that's the area where we, in the Lonergan school or whatever, can open on to Heidegger and Wittgenstein in different ways with each of them. But I think that that's what a lot of what their writing is about. It's about utterances under the influence of the higher levels, but already containing meaning.
Right. Is the suggestion that they are differentiated as embodying meaning precisely in the experiencing of them?
I'm saying that there's an empirical givenness of meaning. In the earlier paper, I speak about a minor formal intelligibility. So there's a minor and a major formal intelligibility. And that there's a minor, might we speak of, a minor formal intelligibility. What's his name? Sean McGraw's way of formulating the same question in a Thomist framework is there a lesser illuminatio prior to the illumination of phantasm by age and intellect as in response to inquiry. So, when I looked over the earlier paper in its original form from the spring of, from the Boston workshop in 2003, I looked it over last night, and I recalled from reading the early part of it how tentatively I was putting this forth in Boston. And since I wanted to emphasize that, I was scared because there's some heavy hitters at Boston College, you know. And if Fred Lawrence and Pat Byrne don't like what you're doing, they let you know that, you know. And so I qualified the whole thing by saying this is an exploration, so let's just explore. So maybe I'm still in that exploratory, but I'm a little bit more confident of it, mainly because those two and Michael McCarthy both thought I might be onto something with it, and I respect their views quite a bit, so I have a little bit more confidence in it. Big thing, though, is that I want to find a common ground, so because I think Heidegger and Wittgenstein are extraordinarily influential people, and I think that we need to find a common ground rather than simply engage in dialectic with them. It's advancing positions. I think the way Lonergan read other people, with very few exceptions, was he read them to learn from them. And then he tells you what he learned from them. But he doesn't, most of the time, he doesn't tell you what he found objectionable, because he just lets that go, you know. And he does it with Gadamer, he does it with Rahner, he tells you what he's learned from them. And so I think we need to, I guess I'm telling you what I'm hoping that I might be learning from Heidegger and Wittgenstein, you know.
Not meaning to interrupt, but as I've been thinking about, your paper in 2003 and this paper, it seems to me that, that an example from a Thomist sort of position
that
or
would
perspective
that would be very helpful if you can
would be the kind of work that's been happening in appreciating the literary dimensions of the text, of a text like the Summa. So focusing on rhetoric, focusing on ways of presenting meaning, as opposed to, strictly speaking, the logical links or the intelligibility in that sense, that that already in the in the shape of the argument, even before any intelligibility is brought, Aquinas will be will already be loading the,
but molding it,
molding it already,
patterning it,
so that something like a sed contra that appeals to, say, the Gospel of John, or a passage in the Gospel of John, isn't just about proof texting, but in fact he is evoking a whole memory of associations that precedes the point he's going to make, that provides a context, that that's all in memory, that's all kind of retrieved in terms of symbol and in terms of image and in terms of already patterned meaning that then provides the enriching context for whatever his respondeo is. And it seemed to me that that was somewhat related.
What about the cogitativa in Thomas? You would, I mean, it's been so many years since I've studied that stuff.
I
had just a short time yesterday to look it up after Danny suggested that it might be related to this.
Yeah, I'd have to.
I'll just comment two things. Reading the paper, I kept wanting to make a distinction between complicating the structure and complicating the account of the structure.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think both are valid.
Yeah.
But they're not the same.
No, I agree.
And I think that your paper would, that there's a kind of precision that if you made that distinction explicit, that sometimes you were talking about complicating the structure.
Yeah.
Like when intellectual development is a complication of the structure. And sometimes you're talking about complicating the account of the structure, which probably always lags behind.
That's right.
So
I agree completely. I think I acknowledge the distinction because I do talk about the scale of values sort of in octu exercito and then in octu signato. I mean, it's in the process itself and then in the account of it.
Yeah.
So,
but
I don't acknowledge when I'm doing one and when I'm doing the other. That's okay.
And I think, you know, the expression that you talk about as sort of the structure complicating itself, I think it's a dangerous expression.
Yeah,
unless
unless
you're very explicit about which you're talking about.
Okay, that's helpful. Thank you.
The other thing is that on the expansions of empirical consciousness, since you mentioned Gentile, it corresponds pretty well to his second of his seven functional relationships between experiencing and whatever functions as symbols, namely recognition, where symbols, in recognition, symbols have meaning in the sense that they function to call forth in us the felt meaning.
Yeah.
And now, how can they call forth that in us? Well, it depends on our own intellectual development, what they call forth.
That's right.
And that's why, you know, if you know, I look at a piece of text in Chinese and it doesn't mean anything to me. It doesn't call forth anything to me. Because I don't have any intellectual development for that. So I mean it's what it has to do with is the instrumental acts of meaning. That's really what you're talking about, the instrumental acts of meaning.
Yes, that's right.
So and I think that's perfectly valid within Lonergan. It hasn't been worked out. But you're right, it's the area to go to in connection with Fitz Wittgenstein, because that's what he's really on about. The fact that we have it, that we develop before, you know, there's a development, a training, if you like, in his terms, that we bring to bear when we interact with the world.
And in responding to Sean McGraw, I felt that it was also the area for openness to Heidegger, and Sean seemed to be in agreement with that too. In different ways, it's very, very different. I mean, obviously, they're two very different philosophical worlds. But.
And can I just ask you one last question? I find Lonergan's use of civilization rather strange, because he seems to connect it with the infrastructure, with what you're calling the infrastructure, and the sort of reflective culture is part of the superstructure. But civilization is part of sort of technological developments, etc. It's an unusual usage of civilization.
It's only that's in Topics in Education, where he distinguishes civilization and culture in that way. It relates civilization to the social order and to and culture too. But culture there is not just reflexive culture. It's also culture as a set of meanings and values. In Theology and the Dialectics of History, I would insist that everyday culture is part of the infrastructure, along with the social structures and the political order and everything else. And it's reflexive culture. And I think this is very much in keeping with Lonergan's own distinction between everyday and reflexive culture. Reflexive culture is the superstructure.
Well, what does he mean by civilization?
Well, I think he's using it there. I think he gets it from Toynbee, and it's Toynbee's use of it, it's advancing at the level of the social values, at the level of technological, economic, and political. The way he's using the term in Topics in Education. I don't know that he ever uses it again in the same
context. You see, I haven't looked at Dawson's review of Toynbee. And Dawson's, the idea of civilization that Dawson says is in Toynbee is when all of this gets widely communicated. It's the wideness of communication that constitutes. That's why there are only 21 or so cultures in Toynbee, civilizations in Toynbee. I'm just confused.
Yeah, I'm not really sure what the answer to that. It's a question of Lonergan exegesis. Did I use civilization in here in that sense?
Yes.
I did?
You quoted Lonergan.
Because I wouldn't use it myself as my own in that particular context. I don't think I would anyway.
Gordon? Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt. No, I was just lining up for... I wonder, Bob, if you would comment a little bit more about the habit versus the state of grace. And let me just say something, that habit seems to resonate much more with the transposition into a statistical world with a set of emergences, and maybe grace is a shift in the probabilities, as I think I was sort of talked down south of the border there too, in that Boston.
Yeah, I think that's right.
And so what's at stake, or what's the nuance, or what's the meaning that you would associate with a shift from habit to state?
He acknowledges the habit.
Yeah.
He's got several statements. Well, he's got a treatment of the habit of grace in the same chapter, but he just makes a distinction between, and to my knowledge, it's original with him, a distinction between the habit and the state. And he explicitly describes the state of grace as a social and intersubjective situation, the three divine subjects and...
So is it an eschatological insight?
No, it's also it's not just eschatological. It's if it were, then we couldn't talk about social grace in history. You know, it can be realized in history. It's realized when you've got it should be what the church is mediating, and many times it is what the church is mediating in the world, when it's mediating peace and reconciliation among human beings and that sort of thing. You can use eschatological and anagogic imagery to describe it. The lion lies down with the lamb and all of this sort of thing. But it's the communities reconciled, social reconciliation, reconciled. You know, what we say in the third Eucharistic prayer, that the Father reconciled us, not just one person, all of us. You know.
So we're really going back to the sense of the sanctifying grace and the habit of charity, or?
I still see those as sanctifying grace is given to the individual, but the state of grace, what he wants to reserve that for the community, for a set of relationships. Yeah, the divine missions are for relations. They are the objective of the divine missions is a set of relationships, and so the state of grace is the set of relationships that's brought about by the missions of the Word and the Spirit when those missions are received by us. That's an intersubjective relationship of all of us to one another and to the three divine subjects. And we're in that all the time. We don't acknowledge it all the time, but we're in it.
I'm wondering, though, if we're not talking about a development from or an expansion of charity, or the understanding of charity.
Oh, probably.
Because one of the things that Thomas insists on in the virtue of charity is that it's friendship with God and with others.
I was just thinking in terms of the four-point hypothesis that where I think it starts. I had lunch with Colin Maloney the other day, and he wants to make sure, and this is brand new to me in terms of my thinking about the four-point hypothesis. Now, we acknowledge that active spiration is not at all distinct from paternity and filiation. And so sanctifying grace is a participation. When we say it's a created participation in active spiration, it's a created participation in paternity filiation, breathing forth love, you know. He wants to get the Christic in there, and we get it in there by realizing that active spiration is not distinct from filiation. From the paternity affiliation together. So he wants to keep Christ in there, and I think that's right. Anyway, that's an aside to the issue here, but it's something that I want to make sure that I emphasize. Does that help at all? I don't have the context of chapter 6 here with me, just where he brings that. Leo just defended a thesis on De Deo Trino this morning.
Dr. Cyril.
Just simply to add, because there are a number of dimensions, I think, to the distinction, but just to mention one that hasn't been mentioned. As I was reading that and pondering its possible meanings, it seemed to me that on the one hand, the state of grace is the basis for Lonergan's notion of universal soteriology. It's on that basis that we're all on an equal playing field. The habit of grace is acquired by those who respond to it. Not all are saved, even though all receive the gift. So that's another dimension.
The universal soteriology he didn't explicitly have when he wrote De Deo Trino. That's a later thing.
He does say all, though, at one point, does he not? Text, does he somewhere say God, all people receive this gift?
Maybe he does.
I must go back, but I think he does.
And I may be wrong that he didn't have it, but I think he was still more restricted in his...
I'm surprised when he did say it that he wasn't... called on the carpet for, because it's not that it's bad Catholic theology by any means, but it certainly wasn't current. The notion that there was salvifically a level playing field, as it were.
Well, as you said this morning, you know, he had to be very circumspect in writing those things in the context that he was in.
Yeah.
He himself said, if I had written Insight in Latin, they might have read it and I might have gotten in trouble.
Did I ask a question of my own?
Yeah.
It changes the subject simply because it's what occurred to me when I was first reading it, when I picked it up on Tuesday and on the way home in the streetcar, just reading it. And I was remembering when Father Crowe used to come to these gatherings, and periodically he would make a distinction, which he was always very adamant about, that we distinguish between what he called Lonerganism, and that is to say, what did Lonergan say? Mm-hmm. What's the doctrine? What's the theory? And what Lonergan is for, which is to enable us to verify things for ourselves and not appeal to Lonerganian texts. And so I was wondering when I was reading it that the question of verification, if a Patrick Byrne disagrees with you, where does the verification lie? In going to Lonergan or verifying it in your own experience?
Oh, the second.
Of course. And the reason I, it was a kind of a burning question because, as I mentioned, this, I returned to picking away at my reflections on aesthetics, and I just happened to be on the question of verification, and a different approach, but the same approach to the notion of complication. As I was saying to myself, I was reading it over, this reads very much like what I've been saying in the dissertation, but I want to appeal to a less informed audience. Mm-hmm. So how do I talk about the fact that when I'm being attentive, I'm an intelligent, responsible, reasonable person with a history, so I'm not simply some kind of nerve exposed to the phenomena of nature. I'm present. I'm present as experiencing, and I'm not asking questions, but I'm, the quality of my experience is intelligent, and it's reasonable, and it's moral, and it's religious. And the only comment that I wanted to make there was that if there was anywhere along his thought that requires the use of diagrams, simple graphics, to help people understand what that means. Because we all go through the period where we tend to separate experience, understanding, judgment, and say, well, now I'm experiencing, that's all I'm doing, now I'm understanding, that's all I'm doing, now I'm, you know, all that kind of thing. Which is really not true to the process.
But, I mean, he himself is always appeals to the pedagogical function of the diagram as providing an image for insight. You know.
Yes. So I'm saying that.
Repeats that frequently.
So what I did when I arrived at home was draw.
Yeah.
And some simple graphics to illustrate it. So I was very sad. Thank God, that you brought it up in that way. Because it got my imagination working. But the other point, the first one, on the question of verification, and that's always the difficult thing, because onus goes back on the person who has to decide for him or herself. Like Lonergan says, we're not talking about theory, we're talking about its basis and interiorities. So when we...
I certainly agree with you, and I mean, I said where the locus of verification is, but I always like to have some support in the text.
It is not bad to be
engaged.
And
I look for it if I can find it. You know, I mean, an earlier instance of this in my own experience was with the notion of dialectic and the contrast of the contraries and the contradictories, because that met with some opposition for a while. But the texts and insight, there are certain texts and insight that cannot be interpreted in any other way. And I don't have the book with me now, but I quote them.
212.
212. It just can't be interpreted in any other way. So, thank you.
I just remembered from the
What about the collective responsibilities? Anybody got any thoughts on that? Because I don't think Bernie himself got there fully in natural right and historical mindedness was the question with which he started the paper. And he's saying, we really don't have a notion yet of collective responsibility. But it's a possible and desirable thing to develop.
Well, do you know where you find it in spades? I went to Yom Kippur services a couple of years ago. Spent the whole day, as pious Jews do, in the synagogue and read an enormous number of texts. The prayer book that you go through is quite thick. It's all focused on collective responsibility of people. There is the recognition and the acknowledgement of individual sin. And once again, it's an instance where the wealth of Jewish theology and their reflection on their religious experience, inspired by the God who chose them and elected them, has a great deal to offer Christian theology. They have a tremendously rich notion of communal responsibility.
That's very helpful. Thank you.
And in their modern writers too, especially in the Reformed tradition, you'll find works that will excite you.
Okay. That's very helpful.
Just something occurred to me when you were asking the question right now. Maybe the notions of power and authority that are at work in dialectic of authority might be elements that we're going towards, because it is a notion of power residing in the community first. So as the more sort of the more positive spin on Foucault's knowledge power.
That's good. It's a very good suggestion. Okay.
I'm a little uncomfortable with the multiplicity of operators. And I'm just wondering whether or not we can find a way of reining the number in.
Well, I don't intend to add any more.
But what I'm really thinking of, is there a way of characterizing all of them in terms of one?
Oh.
And I'm thinking maybe that, you know, that little remark at the end, towards the end of Insight, about all things desiring God, mm-hmm. might be a way of, that could be regarded as a concrete universal, which, on the basis of which all other operators that we come up with are something like, perhaps, you know, ordinal modalities of it. So,
as long as you allow those in there, then otherwise it becomes undifferentiated.
I don't want to see. Why does he use the word quasi in that text?
I don't know. I'm not sure. Yeah. And I tried to get him to say back in 74 when. The first Lonergan workshop, I presented an initial presentation on psychic conversion, and I was scared out of my wits, and I was going neurotic, and I'm talking about psychic conversion. because it was so, I was really frightened, you know, getting up in front of these people. But, and I talked about symbolic operator, and that's the expression that I use in the dissertation. But then when a year or so later, when he started talking this way, and some of it was as a result of communication between the two of us, which he says in Philosophy and the Religious Phenomenon, that when he finally does talk about symbolic operator, he says, this was suggested to me by Bob Doran. So, he didn't want to say operator yet, you know? And for me, with the psychotherapeutic process that I had been through and recognizing the function that dreams had played in a large part that they had played in a certain development in my life for over a period of a number of years, there was an operator there. It wasn't quasi. It was real. It was, you know.
But you see, if you thought of it another way, that you use the word quasi because it's just an aspect of something else. So that there's basically one operator, and all of these other operators that we come up with, along the line, so to speak, you characterize them differently because the objects are different. But underlying all of that, there is just really one operator, namely the desire for God.
Well, that's analogous to the notion of being being differentiated into several different objects at different levels.
So, yeah.
Okay. If that's what you're saying, yeah. I have no problem with that. But I do want to distinguish, for instance, in the Ignatian context of the second and third times of making elections, the questions are the real operator in the third time. But I think affects are are operators. They may not be the only ones, but they are operators in the second time. They operate the development towards a decision. And so I think there's a, so, but I mean, if in the suggestion that you're making is, I don't have any problem with that at all. As long as you acknowledge that, just as with the notion of being, you've also got to distinguish that there are these different objects along the line towards the final objective.
Yeah. You see, in all those cases, I would say being as true or being as good.
Sure.
I wouldn't.
Someplace in second collection, the phrase is used, he's talking about the transcendental notions, and speaks, phrases something like this, three successive stages of one intending.
Yeah.
And that...
That fits in with what I'm
suggesting. That's fine.
So the point is three, but there are three successive stages of one, that's the...
But see, I mean, even in Lonergan's quite... over and over and over again, we talk about operators. Questions for intelligence are very different. They're different from questions for reflection and from questions for deliberation. So he does talk about...
Yeah. See, I think there are two things. He got the analogy from mathematics.
Yes, that's right.
And this talk about the passions of being, he's really trying to find an underlying characterization. That in a sense gets away from the sort of the origin of the mathematics.
Sort of the single operator, I guess, is identical with the transcendental intention, which is distinguished in three phases, which breed three classes of questions. But the talk of the passionateness of being seems to imply an operator which precedes the transcendental intention of the real. And I don't quite know what to make of it.
Yeah, but see, we're part of the universe, and the universe has a desire for God.
Yeah. Yeah, that's it.
But when you put it that way, you're talking metaphysics, right?
Yeah.
Yes.
Right.
And desire in various shades of meaning, I suppose.
Well, I mean, you know, you change the word finality.
Oh, okay. Right.
Yeah, I mean, desire is metaphorical there, yeah. but you know, he also says, aside from the cert of sin, the universe is in love with God. So, but that's definitely, in one sense, that's metaphor, but there's a real meaning to it. It's quite beautiful. He does speak of symbolic, he uses symbolic operator as preceding in the one paper, The Philosophy of the Religious Phenomenon, the one that he never published, which I'm relying on.
Jeff. Professor, in the concluding page of the essay, you make reference to the common sense pattern and the integral scale of values, both as instances of complicating the structure. Second last page. I wonder, beyond that, what the relationship between the common sense pattern and the scale of values is, if any.
Second last page.
Second last page. starts with, that becomes even clearer perhaps when the treatment of common sense is integrated with consideration.
So. So, with regard to the scale of values, I applied two other pieces of meaning, find concrete instances of the complicated structure and set the complicated structure in motion. And in the course of doing that, we saw how it was possible for Lonergan to say that one instance of complicating the structure can be found in his treatment of common sense and insight. That becomes clear, okay, when the treatment of common sense is integrated with considerations of the scale of value. Your question is, how are the
does the common sense pattern inform the scale of value in any way?
Does the common sense pattern inform the scale of values? Common sense is basically, if within the scale of values, as I've tried to differentiate, it's basically the everyday level of culture. As that functions spontaneously, it's in there at the level of cultural values.
Well, what I have in mind here is something I'm working on right now. There seem to be two positions on the common sense pattern. Flanagan, Joseph Flanagan, seems to say that common sense pattern engages more than just experience. It engages understanding insofar as there's an intelligibility about pragmatic concerns.
Oh, yeah.
Comparing and contrasting things based on similarities and differences. So he's saying that common sense pattern goes beyond the first level.
Oh, definitely. Common sense is understanding.
But Kidder seems to disagree and say that the common sense pattern is an exclusive, I think, an exclusive first level activity. Is that?
I doubt that Kidder would say that. I really do. I think Paul knows Lonergan well enough not to say that. Common sense is understanding. It is a form of understanding. It's understanding things in relation to us.
A restricted intelligibility, but nevertheless,
it is
the common sense pattern seeks intelligibility in a practical kind of way.
But it's Socrates knowing what courage is without being able to define it, isn't it?
That's
an example.
That would be an example of it. You know, and at the level of common sense, you know what courage is, but if I asked you to give me a definition of it, you'd be as stymied as the Athenians were. Unless you've read Aristotle.
I just asked it because you said that EUJD were engaged, experience, understanding, judging, and deciding, were engaged on all of these levels of the integral scale.
Yeah.
But if the common sense pattern has a restricted engagement of intelligibility, then I'm wondering how is judgment and decision engaged when dealing with culture?
A lot of the playing out of the scale of values is in common sense, you know? I mean, and part of the problem with the breakdown of the scale of values is the bias, the general bias of common sense, that it won't go beyond common sense. It refuses to raise the further questions that demand theory, long-range issues, and that sort of thing. So,
I wonder if it might not be helpful to specify that the restriction of common sense is not in terms of level.
No.
It's, you know, like there is judgment in common sense, there is decision.
Yep.
But it's rather in terms of how judgment is exercised and about what judgment is exercised, what counts for verification. It's a question of the difference between making a judgment based on the intelligibility perceived in a set of terms and relations, or making a judgment in terms of intelligibility connected with me. So the for me in common sense is part of the.
Okay, great. That's very helpful.
For the links that people see are examples of that would extend what Bob is talking about. Leo gave an illustration of Jewish theology of something that might help by way of a communal sensitivity to grace. Ideas, novels, movies, contemporary things that plug into this.
What about
please don't say
responses to disaster? What about those spontaneous communal responses to disaster, for example? Is that an example?
Coming together of people after the 9/11 disaster.
Yeah. Reconciliation. That level of grace of people being reconciled in the midst of that.
This is more a question than a suggestion, is the suspicion that the nature of collective responsibility is something really more profound than simply collaboration of individually responsible persons?
Well, it's a good question, because as I read the paper, Natural Right and Historical Mindedness, he seems to say, this is about as far as I can take it now, but I'm not sure that it isn't more than that.
So there's a suspicion that there's more to it than just characterizing it as responsible individuals
it's
collaborating.
Like, it's like a mentality that informs, you know, community, I think, or something along those lines.
Would you say it's the flip side? I mean, social sin is surely more the, yeah, you know, the way that individuals have gone wrong, so correlatively.
Yeah.
There's a movie.
You've got an emergent point?
Well, there's a question mark over my head. And it's a question mark that comes out of almost near total ignorance, and comes mainly out of listening to the conversation. But it sounds, I mean, in the question that you all raised, the thing that you were uncertain about or uncomfortable with, sounds like you're saying that for an adequate notion of collective responsibility, or communal responsibility, there has to be some sense of, dare I say, communal experience. Is that fair at all? Or I'm translating into entirely different terms.
No, you're not. That's okay. That's fine. Shared experience, definitely.
Yeah.
Shared experience.
So, I mean, you're saying that all...
You don't have community without common experience.
Of course. Yeah. Well, common experience, but it sounds like the questions that were being raised, if I understood them at all, and I may not, was that part of the complication is to say that experience itself as a level of consciousness is complicated by understandings and judgments.
Oh, I see what you mean.
Right? And so communal responsibility comes not out of just collaboration, but then comes out of a communal sense of experience itself. Is that fair at all?
I think this is what I'm trying to get at. I think it's quite fair. And I'm trying to, I don't think I'm there yet, to be able to articulate it as a further complication of the structure,
right,
if you
right.
want. But I think I want to move in that direction. And I think Lonergan, I don't think he felt that he had answered the question that he raised at the beginning of Natural Right and Historical Mindedness, but he opened it up and said, you know, this is, I'll have to, I mean, I've read that paper, I read it over and over and over again, because as I said in class today, it's like listening to Beethoven's Last Quartet. It's like every theme that he ever wrote about comes into those 25 pages, and it's just, and they're all right where they belong. It's just like you see everything there. But I don't know that he felt satisfied that he had answered in the paper that question that you raised at the very beginning. Mm-hmm. He's trying to address the Straussians in the paper. I think the title makes that clear. He doesn't mention that. But Strauss wrote a book called Natural Right in History, and the Straussians were big at Boston College. And I think he's trying to address them in a paper called Natural Right and Historical Mindedness. And he's trying to take their question seriously, but to give a different answer to it. Because for them, nature and history were incompatible. And Lonergan's trying to say that natural right, natural law, and historical consciousness are not incompatible. But he's trying to push that to the point of how out of this natural right, which we inherit from Aristotle's notion of it, we can develop a sense of communal, collective responsibility for history, for history. Because otherwise the Straussians are right. If we can't collectively be responsible for our history, then natural law and history, historical consciousness, are incompatible. And classicism, some reversion to classicism is almost dictated. And Lonergan didn't want to go that route.
So we get down to our deadline. We've got time for one more question.
It's not really a question, it's just in response to give an example. It may be obvious, but what about a chapter? In our tradition, in my religious community, chapters are important because they're the place where everyone has voice and takes responsibility for this mission. And we strongly believe that the Spirit is present there.
Mm-hmm.
So that what about, so we become responsible to the chapter, to mm-hmm. visit to the presence of the Spirit of the chapter. And at the same time, decisions that are made are subsequently responsible.
They're communal decisions.
They're communal decisions, and everybody has the right and responsibility to vote or not to vote.
Good example.
At that point, where we thank the presenter for his
Well, I want to thank you for